the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT, stay tuned.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. We come to you every second Wednesday of the month between 6 and 7 p.m. We are by, for, and about older women, and my name is Laura Yaris. I'm your co-host today. We have our dear colleague Marlène Rateau, who is our other co-host and one of our interviewers today. We're going to be featuring an interview with poet, novelist, short story writer, storyteller, and many other things, Marie-Célie Agnan. She was born in 1953 in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and she's been living here in Canada since 1970. She has 4 novels published, a book of short stories, 3 books of poetry, 8 books for school children, some for younger children, and some for more teenagers. And she was nominated for Governor General's Award, and she also won the Prix Alain Grandbois in 2017 for one of her books of poetry, Femmes des Terres Brûlées. Her works have been translated into Spanish, English, Dutch, Italian, and Korean. She writes in French. She's also done some translation, and she talks about an interesting book that she translated, and you'll hear about that during the interview. So we're going to start that right now with our colleague Marlène taking it away.
Nous accueillons aujourd'hui Marie Célien, auteure d'ascendance africaine de livres de différents types comme la poésie, le roman, la nouvelle, le conte, sans oublier des textes ponctuels en grand nombre. Elle est aussi une traductrice et le dernier livre qu'elle a traduit, Partition pour femmes et orchestre, qui parle de l'existence de l'orchestre féminine de Montréal. La Symphonie féminine de Montréal, c'est le titre du livre, dirigé par la chef d'orchestre Ethel Stark, paru aux éditions du Bonhomme Ménage. Mais aujourd'hui, nous l'avons invitée suite à la publication d'un de ses poèmes dans le journal Libération du 25 janvier 2021. Marie-Célie, peux-tu nous dire quelques mots au sujet de ce poème et du contexte dans lequel il a été publié?
Eh bien, je voudrais d'abord commencer par saluer nos auditrices. Je suis contente de pouvoir vous parler un petit peu de ces choses qui m'occupent et me préoccupent, dans le sens où, bon, l'écriture, c'est mon occupation quotidienne depuis plusieurs années et qui me préoccupe dans le sens que, bon, il faut trouver le temps pour écrire, il faut trouver le temps, il faut suivre ce qu'on écrit, surtout quand on essaie de vivre de l'écriture. Je dis j'essaie parce que, bon, depuis que je me consacre à l'écriture de manière quotidienne et je vis de l'écriture. Souvent, je dis que j'essaie de vivre, c'est pas facile. Je ne veux pas dire chichement parce qu'il faut pas non plus insulter les gens avec lesquels la vie se montre très chiche parce que bon, j'arrive quand même à en vivre, même si je dois faire autre chose comme la traduction, comme tu viens de le dire, Marlène. Mais la poésie, c'est... Tu m'as parlé de ce texte qui a paru dans Libération. La poésie, je dis souvent que c'est la fenêtre qui m'a menée à l'écriture. J'ai débuté dans l'écriture avec la poésie que j'écrivais depuis l'adolescence, sans avoir en tête l'idée que j'allais vraiment devenir écrivain, mais j'écrivais comme quelqu'un qui aime chanter, chantait. Et ce texte qui a paru dans Libération, c'est très étrange parce que c'est... On pense que c'est un nouveau texte, alors que c'est l'un des plus vieux textes qui il a paru dans mon premier recueil, le premier livre que j'ai publié, je pense que c'était en 1994 ou 95, je ne me souviens plus vraiment, mais c'était mon premier recueil et mon premier livre. Et voilà, c'est...
Le recueil s'appelle Balafre,
je pense. Oui, le recueil s'appelle Balafre, il a été édité par le Sidica, qui est une maison d'édition et en même temps un centre de documentation afro-caribéen. Alors, ce qui est arrivé avec ce recueil, c'est que il a toujours été, comment dire, consulté, lu, apprécié, traduit par des étudiants, et voilà, il s'est retrouvé dans des femmes en France qui ont débuté une revue dédiée à la poésie, pas aux poésies des femmes, ont décidé de reprendre deux de mes textes dans deux numéros subséquents. Et voilà, il y avait un premier texte, je ne me rappelle plus lequel ils avaient choisi pour le numéro d'avant, et ce numéro a publié Euménide, qui épouse l'étiquette de nouveau poème, alors qu'il est un poème très vieux. Sauf que, bon, est-ce que les textes vieillissent? Oui et non.
Il y en a qui vieillissent bien.
Il y en a qui vieillissent bien. Voilà, c'est ce qu'on devrait se dire.
Marie-Célie, Euménide, tu vas nous dire qu'est-ce que c'est? Parce que j'ai vu qu'on introduit le poème en disant « Poésie aujourd'hui ». La révolte dans le corps ancré.
La révolte dans le corps ancré, c'est une phrase tirée de ce poème que le journal utilise. Les Euménides, au fait, ce sont des déesses de la mythologie grecque qui est quelque chose qui me passionne. Depuis l'enfance, j'ai toujours aimé lire tout ce qui a rapport à la mythologie grecque. C'est des choses dans lesquelles je plonge comme si c'était quelque chose de réel. Je trouve ça, enfin, fantastique. Et c'était des déesses dont on disait qu'elles sont les déesses de la vengeance, mais pour moi, ce sont les déesses de la justice. On les appelait aussi, on les appelle aussi encore peut-être, les Érinées et aussi les Furies. Alors voilà, les Euménides. Au fait, c'est un texte dans lequel je parle de la colère, dans lequel je parle de la révolte nécessaire et la justice aussi.
Alors, on parle de ton premier recueil de poèmes, mais on va parler du dernier. J'espère que c'est le dernier, que je ne me trompe pas. Alors, le dernier recueil de poèmes publié en 2017, je pense, « Femme des terres brûlées », et elle t'a valu un prix prestigieux, n'est-ce pas?
Oui, c'était le prix décerné par l'Académie des Lettres du Québec, le prix Alain Grandbois, dont on dit que c'est enfin un prix convoité, un prix, bon, mais je l'ai eu sans le convoiter. Hein. On nous appelle et on nous dit, voilà, le prix arrive. Alors, moi, je dis, bon, mais merci beaucoup, j'apprécie. Mais voilà, et puis j'étais très, très heureuse. Et c'est un texte qui plaît énormément. Je dis souvent que, bon, c'est peut-être la poésie de la maturité. Je trouve que ce sont, enfin personnellement, je me permets de, comment dire, d'avoir une opinion sur le livre, même s'il est à moi, parce que j'ai toujours une distance très grande face à mes textes. Déjà, lorsque je lis les épreuves que me remet l'éditeur pour les corrections, les révisions, déjà je sens cette distance qui s'installe entre moi et le texte. Je pense que c'est quelque chose de très important et de très salutaire dans l'écriture, de pouvoir avoir cette distance. Vous voyez, enfin, moi, je trouve ça important. Ça me permet de pouvoir soupeser le texte, de pouvoir l'apprécier, de pouvoir être critique aussi face à mon travail, ce que je trouve important. Alors voilà, oui, je disais donc que c'est un texte que je trouve achevé. Et puis, dès sa parution, il a commencé aussi à attirer l'attention. Il y a plusieurs de ces textes-là qui ont été traduits en Allemagne. Peut-être que la revue mènera à un éditeur qui prendra tout le recueil à son aile, je ne sais trop, mais voilà. Et puis il y a une adaptation théâtrale dont on a fait une lecture récemment à Paris. Enfin, et c'est un travail en progrès, comme on dit, un travail qui n'est pas achevé, mais qui se poursuit actuellement en Guyane française, voilà.
Est-ce que tu étais à Paris quand ça passe?
Non, je suis vraiment très poltronne, Marlène, dans ce domaine-là. La personne qui faisait la lecture est partie de la Guyane pour aller à Paris, enfin, travailler, et j'étais censée la rejoindre, mais j'ai préféré ne pas le faire. Alors voilà.
Coronavirus oblige.
Le virus oblige, oui. Et c'est ça que je dis, la distance, finalement. Cette distance est importante, par exemple, pour les traductions. Les traducteurs, enfin, ceux qui traduisent mes livres, me disent toujours, est-ce que tu veux... Je leur dis, non, c'est votre boulot, vous le faites. Si vous avez besoin de moi, vous me demandez. Je trouve important de pouvoir avoir cette distance. Enfin, moi, ça me libère aussi, parce que déjà qu'on a tant à faire, et puis, voilà.
Je sais que... Je vais passer la parole à Laura, mais je sais que tu as quand même... Tu parles de cette distance, mais je parle surtout de ta discrétion comme auteur. Mais on parle de vous, on parle de toi quand même. On parle de toi quand même un peu partout. On reviendra là-dessus. Mais je vais laisser à Laura la chance de poser quelques questions.
One of the things that interested me, Marlène might have already told you, I'm a translator.
That's, yes, she did.
Yeah, I've been a translator since 1987. So I heard that you translated this book that was originally published in 2015 by Second Story Press in Toronto. I know that's a feminist publishing house in Toronto. And it was a book about the Montreal Women's Symphony, which existed between 1940 and 1965, I believe, if I remember my research correctly here. So first of all, I guess I'm interested, did you yourself decide to translate this book and then propose it to the Les Éditions de Remue-Ménage, or did they commission you to do it?
No, they commissioned me. They asked me if I wanted to do it. They feel that it's a book that I would like to, and indeed, I really enjoy doing that work. I really love the not only the book but the personality of Ethel Stark. You know, that woman, she wasn't afraid of nothing. You know,
right? She was the conductor of the orchestra, and I guess she was one of the ones who founded it, right?
In fact, when Ethel Stark decided that she wanted to study music, they would not accept her in the university, and I think she got a grant to study. I forgot the name of the Juilliard School.
One of the best. That's a very prestigious school, yeah.
But in fact, she wanted to be a conductor, but they won't accept her. And she got inside the classroom with her violin, and she sat down. And the teacher and the boys that were there just told her, "Well, what are you doing there? There is no room for you here." You know, two or three times, and she was there. And at the end, the teacher said, "Well, anyway, all she can become is a teacher for children. So just let her there." And that's how she integrated the class for the conductors.
So that's how she learned her skills there, because they figured she wouldn't be able to become a conductor anyway, so
exactly.
They figured,
we can leave her.
Yeah, just let her be there, and she's not going to threaten our jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She's such a personality, but it was at the same time a little sad, because to see how women had to fight, you know, and how unjust it was, you know, unfair, you know, how they treated them, you know, and they had no place to do their rehearsal. They had to go inside, you know, all kind of places with no heat, you know, really, really, really hard for them. But unfortunately, I felt that book should have a little more. They don't know about her. When you talk about Ethel Stark, nobody knows about her. And in fact, it is. I feel that even after she passed away, you know, they still forget about her. And there were women from all kind of milieu, you know, in this orchestra. This is an example. And at the same time, it was when women's voice started to be heard in the province. But still now, you speak about Ethel Stark, nobody knows who she is. And for me, this is too much. This is really unfair. So maybe in a few years, in the schools, you know, and it's a book very simple to be read by kids in high school or whatever, you know.
So. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Was it a difficult book to translate?
It was maybe difficult in a way because there is talks a lot about music, and I'm not a musician. I had to
do a lot of research
about it, but the text itself is not very difficult. Yeah.
So it's more of a biography, I guess, of her and a kind of a biography of the orchestra. Yeah, I understand that there was that there were women from different backgrounds in the orchestra.
Of course, different backgrounds. Yeah, different. Social background also, you know.
Et je me souviens dans la lecture de cette quand l'orchestre devait aller jouer à Carnegie Hall, la peur qu'elle avait que une femme noire qui était dans l'orchestre ne soit pas bien reçue à New York. Elle a tenu compte de ça pour faire en sorte que cette femme-là ne soit pas admise à l'hôtel où les membres de l'orchestre allaient se trouver.
Oui. Oui, c'était au fait Ethel Stark était une visionnaire, elle était une révolutionnaire en quelque sorte, vous voyez, une personnalité mais hors du commun et enfin qui aurait mérité mieux. D'ailleurs, je pense que c'est le seul orchestre symphonique qui a eu la possibilité d'aller jouer à Carnegie Hall, pas dans le sens que c'était bon un exploit, mais c'était considéré comme tel quand même, vous voyez.
Et toi et moi.
C'est un travail que j'ai vraiment adoré faire, même si la traduction, c'est quelque chose qui apporte beaucoup de stress, Laura doit en savoir quelque chose. Parce que lorsqu'on traduit, on a quand même
une responsabilité,
un deadline. Et souvent, il nous faut corriger, je ne dirais pas corriger le livre original, mais surtout quand c'est dans la recherche, vous voyez, ce que j'ai trouvé dans ce livre, c'est que la personne qui l'a écrit, elle voulait tellement montrer cette injustice qu'il y a des choses qui revenaient beaucoup. Peut-être qu'il passe beaucoup mieux en anglais qu'en français. Vous voyez, alors, ça nous met toujours face à un défi, la traduction. Je ne sais pas ce que tu en penses, Laura.
It's true. I mean, the way I was trained, when you translate, you have to make sure that it's a faithful translation, that you don't add anything, and you don't take, and you don't take away anything. So it's like, you can like it or you can not like it. I mean, you know, I've sometimes had to translate things that I didn't agree with, but I had to put that aside, because basically if something is written, there's always a subjectivity to it. Obviously there's a choice of words, or there's different ways of phrasing things, but still you can't, it's a very delicate balance that you, as I say, you cannot add anything and you cannot take away anything. Everything has to be accurate.
But at the same time, you have to find a way to give the best of the language.
Right, you have to make it be as idiomatic as possible. No, absolutely. I mean, for sure, it's always a challenge. Absolute, for sure, it's a challenge. There was one time when I was actually offered a very nice contract. This was decades ago, to translate a book, some kind of alternative health book. I don't remember exactly, but there were some statements in that book by the author that were really, they were homophobic. And, you know, as a lesbian myself, when I saw this, it was very judgmental, and it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, you can't judge these poor people because they're like sick. They're sick and whatever.
Yeah.
And I wrote back to the publisher and I said, I'm sorry, I can't accept this contract.
Yes, yes.
Because I knew, like, obviously I couldn't change the content, right? It's not my book. I don't have the right to change the content. But I wasn't going to participate in promoting that
absolutely
kind of content by translating it and making it look good and whatever, when I saw that this was the attitude, it was like I couldn't do it, and it was a lot of money, but I thought about it for a while. I did think about it seriously, and I remember speaking to I spoke to my partner about it, and I phoned a good friend of mine, actually, long distance. You know, she doesn't live here now in Montreal, and I ended up deciding, no, I'm not accepting this. I'm not doing it, and I didn't do it.
The same thing recently happened to me with religious texts. They were so, you know, I said, no, I can't do that work. I'm sorry.
Thank you. And we're back. In case you've just joined us or have perhaps forgotten, let me remind you that you're listening to CKUT 90.3. This program is called Older Women Live. I'm Laura Yaris, your co-host. Our other co-host today is Marlène Rateau, and you were listening to a conversation with author, poet, novelist, storyteller, and sometime translator Marie-Célie Agnan. We're going to continue that interview shortly, but I just want to explain a little bit about the music you just heard. This was a serenade for wind instruments, cello, and double bass by Antonín Dvořák, conducted by a young up-and-coming conductor named Glass Marcano. Her full name is Gladys Marlie del Valle Vadel Marcano, and she was born in San Felipe, Venezuela in 1995. Now, the reason I chose this piece was because, try as I might, I could not find any recordings of the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra, which was discussed in the interview. The book that Marie-Célie translated, the original title was From Kitchen to Carnegie Hall, Ethel Stark and the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra. The sources that I looked at online said that there were some recordings from the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra, but they were, quote-unquote, hidden away in archives. Therefore, I was not going to be able to get my hands on them at short notice, so I decided to feature some other women conductors, and this is one of them, Glass Marcano. You can look her up online. That's M-A-R-C-A-N-O. First name, Glass. I guess that's her nickname. You can see a few YouTube videos of her conducting, and she looks really great. Looks like she knows what she's doing. We'll be featuring some other women conductors and women's orchestras later on in the program. I'd just like to summarize a little bit for those who don't have a huge understanding of French. Marie-Célie had a poem published recently in a magazine called Libération, but it actually was one of her first poems, even though it was published recently again. It was an excerpt from her very first volume of poetry, and the editors of the journal decided to use one of those poems for publication recently. Writing is very important to Marie-Célie, as you'll hear again when we continue with the interview. She devotes herself to it pretty much on a daily basis and tries to live by it, although sometimes she has to do things like teaching and translating as well. Poetry was really her jumping-off point into writing. She started writing poetry as a teenager, not knowing that she was going to actually become a writer, but that's how things worked out, fortunately for everyone. There's also a theatrical adaptation of some of her work that's taking place in Paris. It's a work in progress. But of course, due to COVID, Marie-Célie is not able to travel there. And she actually likes to take a certain distance from her work once it's completed. And she talked about with Marlène how she feels a certain distance from the work when they send her the galleys to look over just before her work goes to press. And also when her work is translated, she tells the translator, "This is your job, and I'm here if you have any questions, but I don't need to supervise you and be part of that process." So we're going to continue now with the interview between Marlène, Marie-Célie Agnan, and myself.
Tu parlais tout à l'heure de ta grande discrétion.
Oui.
Et je dois dire que on parle de toi à travers le monde, n'est-ce pas?
Oui.
Tes œuvres sont traduites en plusieurs langues. Et tu es souvent invité ailleurs qu'au Canada. Mais en plus, il existe un bouquin de 200 pages, c'est quand même pas rien, qui traite uniquement de ton travail. Son titre, Paroles et silences chez Marie-Célie Agnan. En sous-titre, L'oublieuse mémoire d'Haïti. C'est écrit par un collectif d'universitaires sous la direction de deux universitaires, Colette Boucher et Thomas Sespire. L'introduction de ces deux directeurs, titre « Une voix contre les silences », n'est-ce pas? Alors, ils disent que tu es une voix du millénaire qui regroupe plusieurs identités, qui regroupe haïtienne, québécoise, canadienne, latino-américaine, immigrante et plus. C'est toute une lourde mission que tu t'es donnée. Peux-tu nous en parler un peu?
Enfin, je ne dirais pas que c'est une mission. Je dis souvent que l'écriture m'a choisie parce que, bon, il est vrai que j'ai quelques personnes que j'ai connues lorsque j'étais enfant à l'école et qui m'ont dit qu'elles n'ont jamais été étonnées de voir que je sois devenue écrivaine. Parce que, au fait, j'ai l'impression que quand, lorsque j'étais à l'école, je ne m'intéressais qu'à ça, qu'à tout ce qui est histoire. Au fait, j'aimais beaucoup l'histoire. On étudiait l'histoire générale à ce moment-là, lorsque j'étais, enfin, en classe. Au début du secondaire, j'ai fait toute une partie de mon secondaire en Haïti. Ensuite, on étudiait la géographie aussi. Je me rappelle que l'histoire me faisait... dans mes livres d'histoire, je me posais des questions. C'est-à-dire, ce que je lisais dans les livres me paraissait tellement contraire à tout ce qu'on voyait, particulièrement dans notre histoire d'Haïti, qui est une histoire grandiose, grandiloquente, et je ne comprenais pas. On étudiait l'histoire du monde, on étudiait la géographie humaine, la géographie générale, et ça me faisait rêver. Tous ces fleuves, on énumérait le Saint-Laurent, le Mississippi, le Rio Grande del Norte, le Rio Colorado. Pour moi, ça me permettait de voyager et de rêver, parce que l'écriture, c'est au fait un rêve. Il y a la poétesse Adrienne Rich qui dit que écrire de la poésie, c'est aussi comme rêver. Au fait, dans la poésie, on découvre des choses tout comme on découvre dans les rêves, tu vois. Et être dans un rêve, enfin, depuis l'enfance, j'ai aimé rêver. Alors, j'aimais aussi les langues. Les langues, je me rappelle l'espagnol, dès la première année du secondaire, on nous a intégré l'espagnol. Et pour moi, c'était l'une des plus belles choses qui puissent arriver. D'ailleurs, je n'aurais jamais cru gagner ma vie comme interprète et traductrice en espagnol quelques années plus tard. Tu vois, alors je crois que les choses n'arrivent pas par hasard. On est un peu, sans les choisir, elles nous choisissent en quelque sorte. Moi, je dis souvent que l'écriture m'a choisie parce que je n'avais pas vraiment, une stratégie pour devenir écrivaine. Quand je parle de stratégie, il y a des gens qui vont écrire un livre et puis chercher un éditeur et puis l'emmener. Heureusement pour moi, ça ne s'est pas passé comme ça, parce que si j'avais dû, dès mon premier livre, ou peut-être dès mon premier roman, chercher un éditeur, peut-être que je ne serais jamais devenue écrivain. Parce que par tempérament, je ne pense pas que j'aurais fait la démarche. Et le ciel a voulu que les éditeurs soient sur mon chemin et qu'ils m'ont en premier lieu offert de publier même les livres pour enfants. Mon premier livre pour enfants a été publié parce qu'une éditrice, et je peux bien citer son nom parce que je sais toujours combien je lui dois beaucoup de m'avoir permis d'intégrer ce monde des enfants, de pouvoir être présent dans les écoles, leur conter des histoires, m'amuser avec eux. C'est Catherine Germain qui travaillait aux éditions Urtubiz. Et elle avait lu un de mon premier roman qui s'appelait « La dot de Sarah ». Et elle a cherché mes coordonnées, elle m'a appelée, elle m'a dit, vous savez, je dirige une collection pour les enfants, est-ce que vous voudriez écrire un livre pour les enfants? J'ai dit, mais moi jamais, je ne sais pas comment on écrit pour les enfants. Mais Catherine, comme éditrice, y croyait beaucoup et elle a beaucoup insisté. Et finalement, j'ai écrit plusieurs livres pour les enfants. Et puis c'est quelque chose d'absolument fabuleux de pouvoir aller dans une classe où les enfants ont, quel que soit l'âge, mais surtout j'aime beaucoup quand ils ont entre 9 ans, 9 et 10 ans, ils sont encore très dans l'enfance et en même temps, il y a un cheminement qui leur permet d'analyser, de réfléchir et puis beaucoup de spontanéité et surtout une énorme générosité. Alors voilà.
What kind of subject matter do you write about for children? I'm curious.
Any subject. You know, one of my books, two of my books, which are read into the school when the kids are 11 years old, you know, the first year of high school. It's a book about refugees. It's two novels about refugees, you know. So I think that the kids, I write whatever subject, but you have to know how to talk to them, how to express yourself, and also not to give them too much to carry on their shoulders at the same time, you know.
So do you go into the classrooms and read the books to them, or it's just that they read
no,
the book
no,
and then...
No, no, no. They read the book. The teacher, they put the book at their program for the year, and they invite me to come to the school. And sometimes I do writing workshop with them also.
Oh, nice.
They really enjoy writing. And you know what? Some kids told me one day, if all the literature course would be like this, it would be fantastic. You know? And there is one workshop that I do with them. It's about a picture. I take a picture. Very, very, very often I choose a picture, a very old picture. Let's say picture from the 40s or 50s. And I tell them to invent a story about that picture. And at the beginning, they don't understand what I'm looking for. And when they understand that you can create, that you can go into your imagination and pull out something, ideas and nice things, and they become crazy about it, you know? So this is really one thing in my work that I really enjoy, because half of my production is for adults and the other half is for kids. And I also do the storytelling with them, which is a grace, you know?
Oh, you do storytelling workshops with the children as well?
Yeah, storytelling, yeah.
So have you always done this, or have you done other work as well? Or are you always a writer?
No, I used to be a French teacher. Teacher. I studied to become a French teacher. So I taught French for a few years. I taught in schools. I taught in university at Concordia to the French
French is a second language.
As a second language. I taught in business, in stores. I taught so many places, you know. And I did also other things. When I wanted to stop writing, I start to work as a freelance in research with universities. So I had more time for myself and to work as an interpreter also. So it gives me more time because I don't have an office or a school to go, you know, all day long. So I could arrange my time the way I wanted to, you know. So it was the bridge to allow me to become a full-time writer.
Okay, once you were able to do these things, so you had enough income to devote yourself more to writing.
Well, I won't say that I had enough income. I took a risk, you know, but I felt that I needed to take that risk because at the end I wasn't happy with what I was doing, you know. I wasn't there all the time. I could not accept invitations to go, because when you write also, you travel a lot, you know. I was always invited somewhere. I can't accept the invitation. At the end, I told myself, you know what, you're gonna have to make a choice. And I did, and I don't regret it. And it's hard sometimes because it's a lot of anxiety, but I do translation, I do other stuff, I do a lot of workshops in order to be able to survive.
When did you write your first published work, and how many years have you been writing and getting your work published?
I think that I published my first book. I don't have the book with me now, but I think it was in the 90s, 1993 or 94, I published my first poetry book. And the year after, I had a novel, and right after, I had a book of short stories. And it depends. Sometimes I don't take too much time between one book and another, but sometimes it depends what I have to do. Also, I am not the type of writer who wants to have a book every year or every 2 years or so, you know. The book, I feel that a book takes so much time to mature, you know, inside yourself. Sometimes I say that the book takes, I write the book inside of me before I put it on the paper. So,
okay.
C'est beaucoup de temps.
So what's your favorite genre of writing? Poetry, novels, or short stories? Or...
No, they're all different. They're all different, you know. I feel that if I had to choose, I would choose to write only tales for kids, because I love this world, you know, where we can do everything in a tale, you know. A tree can stop talking, and a tree can walk, you know, or whatever. The river can become an animal, you know, running in the... And I love that. But at the same time, I also need the poetry to talk about the world the way it is now. In my last poetry book, I speak a lot about the situation of women around the world. I need the novels to tell the things that hurts me so much into women's life and into my country, what the world has become today, you know? So a lot of my novel turns around the Haitian history, but I also talk about slavery. I also talk about black women. I also, you know, there is in my last, I have one short story book where there is a story about my neighbor who was a Jewish man. He has a number on his arm, that he showed to me one day, and we became friends. You know, I'm talking about it, and I shivers, you know, because it was like an encounter with this old man and myself, you know. His name was Isidore.
Isidore, yeah.
And the title is Apprivoiser Isidore. It was like I had to learn how to get into that universe that was so close to me. He was always inside his house, like if he was scared of something, you know. And I have stories, I have six stories in that book, and they all in a corner of the world, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I have one story about this guy who came to, he was a Polish guy who came to Canada. And when he arrived in Vancouver, police shot him. And most people forgot about it, but it was in all the news all over the world, you know. This guy died the first day, and he came to join his mother, who were living in Vancouver. And
what?
Something happened.
Taser.
With the taser, yeah. So everything is so different, you know. Each one of these forms of writing, they are all necessary for me to say what I have to say.
Comme Laura demandait, en fait, comment tu évaluais ton travail, je vais citer Françoise Naudilon, qui donne avec justesse le ton du travail de Marie-Célie Ayant. Marie-Célie Ayant écrit pour nous toutes le livre maudit dont nous sommes les pages noircies, le livre des femmes et des filles, le livre des sœurs et des mères, le livre de l'aïeul et de la petite fille, le livre des veuves et des vies brisées, le livre des souffrances qui n'ont pas de nom, le livre des peurs et des tourments, le livre des silences et du plan.
Je te remercie, Marlène. Je pense que tu as vraiment bien choisi. Françoise Naudilon, elle est une prof de littérature qui enseigne mes textes depuis plusieurs années. Et je pense qu'elle a résumé vraiment. Je m'en étais pas rendu compte parce que, comme je disais, que j'ai besoin de tous ces genres littéraires différents pour pouvoir dire ce dont j'ai envie de dire. Au fait, je parle de tous ces gens, des grands-mères, des filles, des aïeuls, de toute cette humanité souffrante. Et puis voilà, c'est un peu ça.
Alors, Marie-Célie, nous te remercions.
You've just been listening to a conversation between myself, Marlène Rateau, our colleague, and multifaceted personality and writer of all things, Marie-Célie Agnan. If you'd like more information, you can look her up online. That's Marie-Célie, C-E-L-I-E, Agnan, A-G-N-A-N-T. There's lots of information in French, of course, but there is some in English as well. Some of her books have been translated into English. You can find them. If you can read French, of course, you'll have no problem. If you'd like to read about the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra, which we talked about earlier in the interview, the original book, written in English, is called From Kitchen to Carnegie Hall, Ethel Stark and the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra. The author is Maria Noriega Rachwal, that's R-A-C-H-W-A-L, and this is published by Second Story Press. This is a feminist press in Toronto. If you'd like to see the French version, the title is Partition pour Femmes et Orchestre, and this is published by Les Éditions Remu Ménage here in Montreal. That's R-E-M-U-E hyphen M-E-N-A-G-E, Remu Ménage. The author is the same, Maria Noriega Rachwal, and of course, translated by Marie-Célie Agnan. Just to summarize a little bit, Marie-Célie studied in high school in Haiti. Of course, she was still in Haiti when she was, at least for part of her high school years, and she remembers studying history and how the history that was written in the books didn't really match what was happening in real life, that Haiti has quite a history and you weren't seeing that in books. Also, geography was something that really fascinated her, learning about great rivers and so on. It just made her dream, and she loves dreaming. And basically that she needs all the genres of literature to be able to say what she has to say. So we thank her very much for her time. She's quite a world-recognized author, and we wish her good luck in all her future projects. A little bit about the music you heard right after the interview. This was a traditional Afghanistan tune or song called Watan Jan by the all-woman orchestra Zohra. That's Z-O-H-R-A, the Afghan Women's Orchestra. This orchestra is made up of young women from teenage years to, I think, mid-20s. And it's actually quite a risk because although Afghanistan does have a very rich tradition of music, when the Taliban came along, they outlawed music altogether. And there are still some believers, I guess, in Afghanistan who believe that music is immoral or should be forbidden, should be banned. So it is a risk for these women, especially women, of course, to be playing music. If you want to see more information about them, there's some very interesting information. A lot of these young women actually live in an orphanage in Kabul, and then some of them live with their families and homes. Most of them are of very modest means, of course. It's really quite incredible. When you can see some YouTube videos of them, and they're dressed in traditional dress. Some of the music they play is classical music that you would hear elsewhere, but they also play a lot of traditional Afghan music on traditional instruments, and it's really wonderful to watch. So check them out. That's Zohra, Z-O-H-R-A. This is just about all the time we have for Older Women Live today. So first of all, I would like to thank our guest, Marie-Célie Agnan, for her time, and again, wish her good luck with all of her future endeavors. I'd like to thank my colleague Marlène Rateau for setting up this interview and for all of her collaboration with me on the program. And of course, to CKUT for making their airwaves available for us to do a show about and for older women each month. I'd also like to remind you that February is Black History Month, and although we've made a small contribution today with our program, remember that it's not just at Black History Month time of the year that we should be thinking about racism and about all the problems we have in our society surrounding that. This is something that exists, unfortunately, 365 days a year, and it's something that we all need to work on, and we need to keep working for change in society so that everybody is treated fairly and equally at all times. So there's many books, films, articles, all kinds of things that you can find online and elsewhere. So please get on the internet, watch TV, do whatever, listen to things, read books, read articles, magazines, you name it, and learn more and more about all of this and try to do something, even if it's a small thing, to fight against our racist society today. So we're going to go out now with a song from, I guess you might have called her back in the day, the diva of the Middle East, or at least the diva of Egypt, a wonderful singer named Umm Kulthum, who I discovered by pure chance when I picked up a CD called Arabia many years ago when I was CD shopping, and I stumbled upon this. It's an anthology of Arab women singers from different countries, and Umm Kulthum was one of the singers. She died, I believe, in 1975, but she was extremely well known. And the reason I'm featuring it today is because I happened to make the acquaintance of a very accomplished young woman, and when I saw her name, her first name, Umm Kulthum, I got very curious and I asked her, "Were you named after the singer?" And in fact, she was. Her parents are big fans, and she herself also really loves this singer and still listens to her songs. So I would like to dedicate this song by Umm Kulthum. The song itself is called Matrawak Damak. I'm sorry, I don't know what that means, but I hope you enjoy it. This song is by Umm Kulthum, dedicated to Umm Kulthum. And I'll remind you that you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. We'll see you back here at Older Women Live next month. Be safe and be well, everyone. Take care.
Matrawak Bonsoir et bienvenue à Amandla, votre émission hebdomadaire sur l'Afrique, les nouvelles, l'analyse. Et ce soir, nous vous présentons un entretien que Doug Miller a fait avec Mouloud Idir sur Bouchra Manaï, qui est devenue la toute première commissaire au Bureau de lutte contre le racisme et les discriminations systémiques à la ville de Montréal. Alors, c'est un développement très, très important et Doug et Mouloud regardent ça ensemble. Alors, c'est ça qu'on fait ce soir en français. And Helden in English, what's up for tonight?
Yes, thank you, Gwen, and welcome to Amandla, our weekly African Current Affairs program produced both in English and French on CKUT 90.3.